know, we have received quite a lot of submissions, both written and oral. A few of you made oral submissions, but a bigger number had submissions. So without wasting time,
committee members. Can we just check, first of all, we will not be dazzling you with a PowerPoint presentation today. We have a rather lengthy matrix. I'm not that it gives in our spirit to dazzle people, but we have a rather lengthy matrix today, approximately about 60 pages, and that committee members should have in front of them, printed in sort of a booklet form. There have been a number of comments on the bill from a variety of sources, which is always welcome, because the more comments you get, the good, the bad, and the ugly, so to speak, the stronger your piece of legislation at the end of the day. And that, I mean, that's what we all here for at the end of the day, to build a robust and a set of legislative laws that work. If you have a look at the matrix in front of you, you'll see that there are a variety of columns, and the last column is the amendment for consideration. We'd just like to highlight to your house that the amendments, if you see amendments in that column, those are yet to be finalized from our side because of the house and the chairperson's grace. We've been given more time to finalize the exact wording of the amendments. So what you see there is indicative rather than a final version. Which will come in the amendment to the amendment bill. It will be our job to finalize subsequent to today. I would also like to just highlight that we'll be dividing the presentation into two parts. Firstly, just to share the workload, Joanne's always got something to say, and we couldn't say no. So she's going to be taking us through about, let's say, half the matrix, and I'll be doing the other half. And so when I fall, but it will be in certain stages, but I'll indicate when that trend will occur. If we can start then, firstly with a comment on the Pension Funds Act. A lot of comments are editorial in nature, so I'm not going to spend time talking about saying or grammatical errors, but rather focus on more substantive provisions. So things like the definition of actuary we can chat about, but it's not really adding a lot of value. But we take as a point here that we should be talking about a fellow member rather than just a mere member, because a fellow member is a person who's been admitted as an actuary. Beneficiary fund is the same thing in terms of an editorial correction. And for the next two, for the definition of normal retirement age, we're just going to be aligning ourselves with the provisions in the Income Tax Act. I mean, we have to make sure that legislation speaks to one another, especially if there's overlap. And as the House will know, there's clearly overlap between the Income Tax Act, which has a number of pension type laws in it, and the Pension Funds Act itself. There were also comments on the definition of pension funds. We're suggesting merely a clarification in terms of an editorial change, and making doubly clear that it is all payments that are made in terms of Section 37C. So that would include death benefit payments, as the commentator was commenting, which would have to be made into a registered beneficiary fund. It's wording that will be proposed later on that clarifies that and makes it tighter, but that's not the subject of the definition in this instance. If we move to over the page, when it concerns retirement and retirement date, once again, it's aligning with the provisions in the Income Tax Act or the Revenue Law Amendment Bill that have been recently tabled. With respect to unclaimed benefits, three issues were raised in the first instance, which we can quickly look at, and that was transfers on behalf of pensioners, any liquidation benefits, and surplus payments. And there were questions by commentators around those, so we're clarifying that, yes, transfers on behalf of pensioners should be included. Clarifying that liquidation benefits would be included if they remain unclaimed once liquidation has occurred, and also that surplus payments are, in fact, included in the definition of unclaimed benefits, again, where those surplus payments are not claimed.
Let me just clarify one thing. Where you say commentator that you should say 5.11.24.25, you mean in terms of your list,
Yes, sir. In terms of the list at the front, which is labeled 1 through 28. Unfortunately, time didn't permit us some consistency, and we will have to take the left for that because that changes about how we make it so we actually give the commentator's name. But here we can always effect some editorial amendments to this. If we deal with unclaimed benefits, then we continue over the page onto page 4, you can see there we are clarifying wording, as I was saying, and that runs for quite a while until you have page 5. So it seems quite a lot, but their column's quite small. So what it's done is our amendment is if we move to clause 2A, which deals with the registration of beneficiaries' funds under this Act, there were a number of questions, and I also remember the Association of Trust Companies raising some questions in their presentation. For instance, is it the intention that beneficiary funds are only allowed to register from the 1st of January 2009? So couldn't they register now? And we're saying no, we're not saying that you couldn't register now if you really wanted to. We have no objections to beneficiary fund wanting to do that at the moment. So we've suggested clarification in the wording, which is in the last column, to make it so. The further question was, would existing trusts be allowed or be required rather to register? And that we highlighted in our initial presentation to the committee that it's quite a thing to disentangle current trust money which has already been transferred into the trust environment from beneficiary funds. One reason for that would be that in the trust environment, the assets are vested already in the beneficiary, but in the pension fund environment, the assets are actually vested in the fund. So there are legal issues around that. It would also be a huge administrative exercise, and some may say now impossible, to disentangle a certain trust which may have an agglomeration of a whole different type of benefits, to then require all those trusts to suddenly register as beneficiary trusts as well, and then to disentangle which benefits go where. So what we're proposing is let this be done on a voluntary basis if it's legally permitted and agreed to by the beneficiaries, rather than a forced transfer of people from the current environment. What we are, however, not changing on, and I think commentators agree on that, is that moving forward, all Section 37C monies, relevant Section 37 monies must be paid to beneficiary funds. The next comment, which deals with exemptions, must be published in the Gazette, which just effected a small amendment because it's impractical for every single possible exemption to be issued in the Gazette. It would, in practical terms, mean the registrar would spend every day publishing hordes of notices. So it's where relevant, I think, that's important, not necessarily every single exemption, irrespective of how minor it was. On clause 3, and clause 3 deals with the exemptions by the registrar when it comes to the board of a fund, there were a number of comments. We disagree with most of these comments because most of the comments revolve around the registrar shouldn't be exempting funds from the requirements of the fund to elect members. Now, the problem with that is, and this isn't a really tied to this current bill, it would go back to when this provision was first inserted, is how do you manage an election of trustees in a retirement annuity fund, for instance, where people may not know each other, they don't belong to a common employer, they're from all over South Africa. So there are certain circumstances where you would need some flexibility for the registrar in that regard. There's also some editorial amendments, which are the last two amendments in that clause, which I'm not going to be speaking about now. On clause 4, which deals with the principal officer, there were a number of comments, mostly but not exclusively by the Principal Officers Association, and we addressed these here. As was pointed out in the hearing last time, there's a difference where the POA said the registrar must not be given the right to hire and fire a principal officer, and he was saying, well, if you read it carefully, you'll see that it's merely a vetting procedure. It's not a case of the registrar will be taking CVs, reviewing CVs, appointing principal officers. That's the function of the board and not the registrar. If we turn over the page, which still deals with the principal officer, there were other comments which said that the process and notice period should be made clear. We agree with that comment, and we are proposing some sort of revised wording to make that process more clear to those in the industry. Then there was a further comment, and the only comment that I want to put is this under that clause, which is that the registrar power should not be limited to new appointments, but also to appointments prior to the Act. So what the commentator was saying there was the registrar should right now go through a thorough review of every single principal officer of every single fund. He was saying that, I mean, that's not the intention. What we're granting under this Act is the power of the registrar to remove an officer if it's found that that person is not sitting properly. That could still apply to a person who's currently currently a principal officer of the fund. But it's not envisaged that a process right now would be commenced to review the position of every single principal officer at the moment. Going forward, of course, the fit and proper requirements apply to everybody, no matter when they were appointed, irrespective of when they were appointed. If we move to Clause 5 and Clause 6, Clause 5 and Clause 6, remember, dealt with auditors and actuaries. The comments there were that we should allow bodies such as IRBA or the Actuarial Society of South Africa to take action against these officers. So it shouldn't be left to the registrar, really. It should be left to those bodies, and we don't agree with that. We think that should rest with the registrar and not with those bodies. For instance, they may not even be statutory bodies. So it seems strange to almost rest the statutory function with the non-statutory body. If we move to Clause 8, and Clause 8 we can spend a little bit of time on because it's a relatively contentious one. It's the one that relates to fees and commissions that are payable when transferring from one retirement annuity fund to another. And the House will remember that there were a number of representations from different industry bodies, and some of those representations are in conflict with each other because obviously people are coming at it from their own angle, and it might sound a bit blunt, but people are trying to put their own interests. We have to navigate the way through that. What also needs to be said is that what makes this exercise complex? What makes this exercise complex is really boiled down to the following. Either the fund is underwritten, i.e. commissions are paid and regulated in terms of a long-term insurance act, or you're in the non-underwritten environment. So RA could be non-underwritten, i.e. it's backed by a collective investment scheme type arrangement, where those commissions are not regulated under the Collective Investment Scheme Control Act or under any other. And when we're saying we don't want fees charged on transfer, we have to really take into account where is the money transferring to and from. And that's what makes 14.7 problematic at the end of the day. So we've taken the points on board by commentators that the original wording we inserted in September last year should be tightened because there are ways to get around it. But this, when you regulate fees and commissions, and I'll admit it from a regulatory point of view, it is sometimes like a balloon. If you squash one end, or you think you're squashing one end, it somehow pops out in another end. So we're hoping it doesn't happen. Are there guarantees to these things? The industry is very inventive, or just the industry is very inventive. They're always people trying to find ways and means of circumventing regulation. I guess that's where the spirit of the law comes in, and some people hold it as a curse and others don't. But we suggested some revised wording on section 47B. And the punchline of that revised wording is that fees can be deducted where the member has authorized those fees and has been fully disclosed to the member. So they know exactly what's going on. If we try and squash the balloon totally, it seems like an almost virtually impossible task to do. So we suggested wording there. The wording is somewhat based on the submission by the ACI, but not exactly. And we can debate the better chair in further deliberations with the committee. On clause 10 and clause 12, those are merely editorial corrections, so I'm not going to be speaking to them. We can move to clause 13, which deals with the beneficiary fund issue. Again, there were a number of issues people raised with respect to beneficiary funds. Some of those involved around, well, what about testamentary trusts, and what about if someone died and they set up a trust under, you know, as a result of that in their will, would money be able to be transferred to that trust, or would it somehow have to go into a beneficiary fund? So those sort of matters we tried to clarify in a proposed amendment, which you can see starting on page 13. And we think it sufficiently deals with the matter. There were other comments, for instance, by the Association of Trust Companies on the detail, which is, what about the powers and duties of trustees? So that's something that the FSB can issue guidance on and regulation on, and also check when the beneficiary fund submits rules to them for approval that things are adequately addressed. Chair, on a general comment with respect to a lot of these comments, people often want a heck of a lot of details to be specified in legislation. Now, there are pros to that and there are cons to that. If you look at financial regulation generally, I think it's for the legislation to set parameters that are detailed enough to give the regulator the guidance as to where the specific should lie. And that is a fine line. People will argue exactly where that line must be, but it's a line we have to tread. So to specify every single thing in legislation is impractical. It also leads to problems, because it means if you specify something incorrectly and you need to change it, you have to go through the entire legislative procedure for something that may actually be quite minor. And that I'm saying with specific references, for instance, the powers and duties of trustees, something that the FSB would regulate when the beneficiary fund comes forward and says, here is my body of rules. Are you satisfied that it's comprehensive enough and conforms with the Act? If I can move on to the next major section, which is divorce. Again, I hesitate to use the term headache, but maybe that's in the right word. It is a headache, not just the process of divorce, which I can't speak of personally. I merely mean, why are we sitting with this headache? Let's start from basic principles. Well, there are two issues. Well, there's really one issue, and that's about should the divorce order be retrospective, i.e., if the divorce order was granted 3 years ago, must the action payment now or mustn't we? And our life would have been very a lot easier in terms of drafting and legislation if it was just going forward. But this House decided collectively last year that should not be the case, and that if the divorce order was, for instance, granted 3 years ago, payments should be made by the fund to the divorcee. And we've balanced lots of debates about divorcees in crying on various people's shoulders about their need access to the money, and should the money be preserved, should it be compulsory preservation, like the LOA was saying. So there are lots of arguments about this, and does it increase the administrative cost of the fund, which naturally it would in just executing that payment. But come to light, and there are tax issues, by the way, as well, that need to be resolved, and that are being resolved by our tax people in the taxation laws amendment book. So we are going to be suggesting revised wording on that section based on the wording we currently have, but we're going to be tightening that up somewhat, perhaps suggesting a lengthening of one or two of the periods in which, for instance, the divorcee can respond or the fund must respond to the divorcee, just for administrative reasons. But we're We are sticking to the House's original intention in September 2007 that divorce orders granted prior to that date must be paid by the fund. There also were comments around the hierarchy of orders that was listed. We will also be drafting tighter wording on that to make it clear as to the hierarchy and how that should be dealt with. So, for instance, if a fund is sitting with two or three orders and they were received at different dates, how do you actually deal with that situation? So in the table, you will see that that runs for quite some time until we're at clause 15. Clause 15, I hesitate to call things minor in legislation, but clause 15 just deals with, apparently there are some really long-standing funds that have trusts, that are effectively trusts, and by deleting a certain section, Section 38 in the Principal Act, we might be creating some sort of loophole for the funds. We don't want to do that, so we're going to suggest a reinsertion of that wording back into the Principal Act. This is where I'm going to pause for now, and Joanne will now, page 919. Joanne will now take us through the amendments that deal with the enforcement committee, which is a major part of this bill. Thank you, Joanne.
In the sense of the comments that we received, also reflecting on how we structured the enforcement committee, which is one of the primary objects of this legislation, we identified the need to include additional amendments just to further clarify when the enforcement committee has jurisdiction and when it acts. And in giving effect to that principle, we've identified that in the Pension Fund Act, we would need an additional amendment, basically removing the administrative or the right of the registrar of pension funds to impose administrative penalties completely so that he will then be able or she be able to refer it directly to the enforcement committee. The only power that will or administrative penalty that will remain with the registrar of pension funds relates specifically to the late submission of documents, because I think that it's very clear if you didn't put on a specific date, it's quite clear what the convention is. So the amendment there on clause 13 basically gives effect to that. If we then sort of proceed to the Financial Services Board Act, you'll see a number of amendments there also relate specifically to the sort of tightening up around the enforcement committee. But I will just take you through the specific comments that we've also received on the Financial Services Board Act amendment. Clause 21 of the bill, which amends Section 10 of the Principal Act, provides for the establishment of the Enforcement Committee, and there were a wording or drafting proposals from EMASA, which we didn't agree with. We felt that the wording were sufficient. Then also there was a question from EMASA in respect of how the committees of the board in general and specifically the Enforcement Committee will be funded. And if the committees will be consulted on their budget. And for us, that's an internal FSB procedure in terms of how it proceeds. Obviously, there is an obligation on the FSB to ensure, or the board of the FSB to ensure that its committees are sufficiently funded to provide or fulfill its functions. We then go to Clause 22, that's specifically also an enforcement committee provision. We're proposing that the clause be amended to ensure that when the enforcement committee is established, that the chairperson of that committee, but all the deputy chairpersons of that committee that will sit on panels, all be from the legal profession. We do feel that it's important that those committees, the committee and the panels, are chaired by legal people. The legislation does provide for additional support and other expertise to be there, but we do feel that the presiding officer should be legal people. If we then move on to clause 27, which is on page 22, which amends section 26. There was also a wording suggestion from EMASA, and we disagree. We feel that the act is quite clear in terms of when an appeal can be lodged against the decision makers' decision, and we didn't feel that that more than 30 days would be sufficient, or that the person, you know, that the wording that on the date of which the person becomes aware of the decision. This is an we don't feel that it really adds anything. The fact is, the moment the decision is made, the person is informed of the decision. And in terms of normal legal practice, there are processes and procedures and how people are informed of decisions. So we didn't feel that it really added to the wording and that the wording was sufficient. Also, they referred back to PAJA and the process and procedures provided for them, the other comments. And I think we've had a, it sort of seems to come up quite a lot, and it seems that people in the financial sector don't know about sort of public sector or basic rights legislation, which is PAJA, promotion of access to information, etc. As we said under the FIC discussions, PAJA, promotion of access to information, all those pieces of legislation apply to all laws of the country. And I think that is sort of just yet another example of where we need not repeat the procedure provided for in PAJA in the bill. If we don't have a specific procedure, PAJA apply. The next comment is on page 23, which is from the OASIS group, which is also related to what we discussed when we were considering, or the committee was considering the FIC legislation. The allegation is made that the enforcement committee, the appeal board, sorry, will constitute a parallel process to the court structures. Now, if we look at PAJA specifically recognizes internal administrative processes and procedures to facilitate speedy resolution of disputes or complaints. And the legislation is also clear that if one has a difficulty or feel aggrieved by a decision of a registrar, you appeal. And once the appeal board has made a decision, that decision of the appeal board is subject to judicial review, which is consistent with the provisions of the Promotion of Access to Information Act. Also, the next comment from Ala A. Lesma on the top of page 24, there was an indication that there might be a conflict in terms of what's currently in the FIC Act and in terms of what we are proposing. We don't agree with that. We think the legislation is clear enough to say that when you appeal a decision against the registrar, appeal against the decision of the registrar is an automatic appeal, where if you appeal against the decision of the ombud, you have to ask the ombud for leave to appeal. And it's clear because the nature of the two institutions are quite different, where the registrar is an enforcer or a regulator, and the ombudsman is a dispute resolution or complaint resolution procedure. However, we have considered to add in an additional amendment to provide further clarity in terms of the application of the section. And in terms of the suspension of the decision, you'll see it arises here under appeal. When we talk about the appeal board as well as under the enforcement committee, and it is also an issue that came up under the FIC amendment bill. Currently, the previous FIC bill and what we provided for in the general financial services general laws amendment bill is to say that the decision of the appeal board and the enforcement committee takes effect immediately. If a person feels that that might be inappropriate or would be to the prejudice of that person, he or she must apply to the appeal board and or when approaching court after decision-making processes or administrative decision-making processes have completed, approach the court to say that the implementation of the decision can be suspended. And I think in the context of financial sector regulation, it is important to ensure that one can take action immediately to protect the public. However, if the person who will be affected, the specific institution will be affected by that decision, that person has the option of approaching the court and of the appeal board to raise about why the decision shouldn't take effect immediately. For instance, if there's a huge, what can we say, pyramid scheme being conducted, and the decision of the registrar or the registrar issues an instruction to stop that business practice. If we are not able to enforce that immediately or ensure that that decision immediately takes effect, by the time we eventually get to complete the administrative process, a huge damage might have been done. If we can then move on, flip over the page to page 25, also a comment from a master. There was a complaint that the procedure of the appeal will be defined by the chairperson of the appeal. We disagree. If one looks at the legislation, it is quite detailed in terms of how the appeal will be structured. What the chairperson of the board will be allowed is that within, when an appeal is heard, as the internal processes and procedures, and you'll see we've got quite extensive an explanation that we've provided in terms of the limited scope in respect of processes and procedures that the chairperson would be able to provide. And that's purely for practical reasons, where it might not be possible at this point to foresee which are the more detailed issues that need to be dealt with at that stage. On page 26, still on Imato's comments, specifically on section 26D. As part of the appeal process, there is opportunity to submit new evidence. However, it is important that the appeal board pronounces on the fact that was initially presented to the decision maker, because otherwise it places the decision maker in a very awkward situation to say, I based my decision on A, B, C, but suddenly now the appeal E, F, and G is coming to light. So the moment what we provided for is if new evidence are presented at the appeal stage, that the chairperson of the appeal board can refer the matter back to the decision maker and saying, in light of A to G, would you have made a different decision or reapply your mind in terms of taking a decision? And we didn't feel that that would prejudice the applicants, and the contrary, it might be to their benefit. I think then we're on to the National Payment Systems Act, which Balan will take over from me again. It's on page 28.
Thank you, Chair. This is much, most relay races are four participants, Chair. It's quite tiring when you're only two participants. But we have been supplied with water, for which we are grateful. The Fifth International Payment Systems Act. Let's review. Most of the amendments that are listed are of a technical nature or editorial nature. Let's look at one of the substantive comments that was made by the Banking Association, which is the first comment right up front here. It says that we should review the entire regulatory framework in terms of risk and risk management, considering the entry of non-bank participation into the payment system because of the added risk that could be posed by non-banks. Now the arguments around competition, well, it's merely a tactic by banks to delay competition, or, the arguments can be made either way. The point is that we think that the system currently is quite well regulated by the South African Reserve Bank. So we don't see that allowing entry by non-banks at the present time is going to jeopardize the entire system. The FARB, in conjunction with the Treasury, will set criteria for participation. Will monitor this closely and will be able to manage the risk much like they do in the current system. This doesn't mean that we don't ever review regulatory frameworks. We do. We are currently engaged in a financial symposium process that not only looks at the banking system, the payment system, it looks at how ombuds talk to each other, how regulators talk to each other, and it's a much, much wider process. But in terms of this comment, Chair, we think that this will be sufficiently capacitated to deal with the matter. There was a general comment by ATM Solutions that SARB shouldn't display a bias. Now, Chair, I'm not going to comment on SARB's bias. I would assume that they're very unbiased, and I think that's just what we see in our response. The rest, Chair, are editorial, mostly editorial, which I'm not going to go through now, but we will answer questions if there are any on those specifics. If we move to the front on page 28,
I forgot that the NPS amendment for only one page. I'm also going to do just all the matters that relate to sort of purely legal or administrative law matters. We continue there under the Financial Institutions Protection of Funds Act on 28. But let me just sort of to add to what Baron said in terms of the NPS. It is basically to create a legislative framework to allow for additional participants in the system. And specifically, the committee is aware of the difficulties that we are experiencing or continuing to experience in respect of the post-bank clearing provisions, and that this amendment will also facilitate regulation, bringing the post-bank into the regulatory system and allowing SARB to adequately regulate it. Because currently it's only cleared through another participant, and that participant is being put under huge pressure and its credibility being questioned. So it is sort of with a broader view of bringing in competition over the long term, bringing long banks into the environment, but also specifically it serves the purpose of also addressing post-bank in a much more appropriate manner. And if we start on page 28 at the bottom, the initial amendment basically flows from what I said initially is when we're looking at the comments and all the input we received, we also deemed it appropriate to just tighten up a little bit on the enforcement issues. And one of the issues is specifically in terms of the alignment of the FIC amendment bill as the committee adopted it and was adopted by the National Assembly last week with the provisions of what we're proposing here. So basically we've just made it very clear that the enforcement committee will deal with all decisions of the registrar other than late penalties for late payment. But if we look at the FIC Act, it creates the right for the FIC to also impose administrative penalties there. So it was important to say that when exercising rights afforded in terms of FIC, that a registrar may refer the matter to the enforcement committee here. So instead of taking the decision themselves, they can refer it. As Baron indicated up front as well, we are full busy just really looking at the wording to ensure that everything is in place as it should be. We're only able to present specific or finalized wording, but as long as the committee is aware of what what our response and what we would want to propose for the committee to consider. On page 30, which is on the on the enforcement committee provision specifically now, the LOA made a comment that the time period stipulated for referring matters to and for the enforcement committee to deal with the matters are too short. And you'll see from our comments that the time frames provided for in this bill it already exceeds those that's provided for in the rules of the High Court. So we've been more lenient than what the courts would be should you approach the court. So we feel that the time frames provided is sufficient. And then they also raised the point that the establishment of the enforcement committee in the FSB Act and then providing for how it functions in the Protection of Funds Act seems a bit odd. We feel that the establishment of the enforcement committee as a committee of the board is appropriate in place under the Financial Services Board, which establishes the board and its other committees. But that we, in terms of the enforcement procedures, that it is appropriate in place. So we've already, it was a discussion, I think, between us and the FSB also in terms of the drafting, and we agreed that it's where it is currently is appropriate. The same point was raised in terms of the enforcement committee, where the chairperson is allowed in certain instances to provide for the procedures that will be followed, and I think the same explanation as applied to the appeal board also applies here, that there are certain aspects where practicalities require process and procedures to be left to the chairperson. Also, the next comment relates to legal representation, that should be a right and not in the discretion of the chairperson. We provided quite a lengthy explanation there for members to look at, but basically what it boils down to is that not all procedures of the enforcement committee would constitute a hearing. In a number of instances, the matter can be resolved on the papers. And to have the support of a legal representative to prepare your papers doesn't impact on being represented or having legal representation at the hearing. So we do feel that certain instances, the cases might also be very simple and quick to resolve. And the intention of the committee is to provide a speedy resolution. And usually in these instances what will happen is that what we don't want to happen is that it becomes a legal engagement only and not dealing with the issues at hand. also the decision of the enforcement committee not to allow, for instance, if the enforcement committee decides no legal representation should be allowed, that that decision is also a part of the full appeal process that's provided for to the court. So if a person feels aggrieved by the outcome and says that they were prejudiced because they couldn't have legal support, that is also a matter that is subject to a full appeal to the court. Over the page, on page 32, Imata raised and LOA raised the point that the jurisdiction of the committee read too wide. We disagree with it to an extent because I think you can only read legislation in the context of the act, or you can read a provision of the legislation only in the context of the legislation which is put in. So if there's a provision to say compliance with the law and the definition of what law constitutes, we thought it was clear enough. However, we, to ensure absolute legal clarity, we are proposing an amendment to the provision to ensure that it will deal with the contravention of law specifically, and then change the definition of law to ensure that FIC is included there as well. So we feel that the small amendment we've made there will make it clear that it's not every law of the country, but specifically laws provided for and listed in the definition in the Protection of Funds Act. Then a question around an unlimited penalty that may be imposed by the enforcement committee. The point was made that we should have a defined penalty. And I think the best response to that is to sort of just refer to the bulking issue that the committee is aware of. If we say 100 million or 200 million is the limit, we all know that in the financial sector, transgressions happen that have financial implications of way exceeding, a reasonable amount, purely because of financial muscle of the people in the sector or the institutions in the sector. And I think the fact is we have been very conscious of the fact that, that within a constitutional framework, we need to be very careful in terms of how we structure our processes and procedures. So from the start, we've been very careful to ensure that we don't impede on people's rights, and we do feel that to have the provision for an unlimited penalty year is appropriate, and we have considered the potential implications of it. And if I can just reiterate, it's very important to have an open-ended provision there, because the enforcement committee can also make a compensation order. And I think that also becomes quite an important aspect. Then the issue around the prosecution, should we be able to have administrative sanctions together with prosecutions or criminal prosecution. I think the state law advice has been very clear in terms of that provision. We still sort of have a legal discussion around that, but they feel that we shouldn't have a double jeopardy. So if there's an administrative penalty imposed, the other way around, if a criminal action has been taken, a criminal charge has been laid, we can't on top of that also impose an administrative penalty. However, if we've already started administrative procedures and a criminal charge has been laid, it will suspend the administrative process. So we've tried to just also make sure, although we do feel that that double jeopardy only arises in terms of criminal law, you know, the same act can't make you guilty of two different criminal offences, and that it doesn't apply administrative penalties vis-a-vis criminal sanction, that we just conceded in terms of being a bit more risk-averse, that it might be the appropriate approach to have a different, or don't allow for both in the same instance. Then in terms of a cost issue, we do feel that that the enforcement committee should have the discretion to make a cost order, depending on how the procedure has planned out. And I think it's also an issue that we discussed quite in detail under the FIC issue in terms of discretion of regulators to recover certain costs in certain instances. The next amendment is on 442, which is also just part of the alignment or closer alignment between the FIC and the FSB legislation. This basically clearly stating that an appeal proceeding under the FIC Act, or that when a decision of the Enforcement Committee has been taken, in respect of the FIC Act, that the matter goes directly to the court and not necessarily the appeal proceedings under the FIC Act. And the last comment is on 42. It's again the suspension of discussing effect of an order of enforcement committee pending approaching the court. We do feel that that should not be the case.
Thanks. Page 35, we now move on to Financial Advisor and Intermediary Services Act proposed amendments, and I'm very happy to say that there are at least two SSD people who know this infinitely better than I do here with us today. So, and I will gladly defer any questions to them later. So that means if they were napping, they're not allowed to nap anymore, Chair. Firstly, on clause 44, there's just an editorial change where, because some people are objecting to the words visible, so we don't think it's very material to change to readable, but that's minor. On clause 45, which deals with on-site visits, there were quite a number of comments on the whole issue of on-site visits. To what extent can you have these visits? Who can visit people's premises? What documents can they seize, etc. So if we go through some of the comments there, there was, for instance, a comment that there should be specific persons only that can enter on behalf of the registrar to conduct an on-site visit. We disagree with that. The registrar should be flexible to appoint any person that he deems fit. Obviously, the registrar is not going to appoint people willy-nilly, and he will select them, he or she will select them with appropriate care. The Inspection Act, which governs when the FSD, for instance, can go in and see, or the inspectors in the FSD can go in and see the documentation, doesn't have this restriction in it either, so we don't see the need for it here. There was also a comment that the registrar should only order an on-site visit if there were reasonable grounds, and I think the committee had rebutted that already in the hearing initially, that you can't only act if you see smoke. You have to sometimes go in before the fires begin, and before this smoke even exists, Chair, you may need to go in. So we disagree with any amendment that tries to quash that right. Then there was a number of comments that, as I said, that the registrar's powers were too wide, and we have in one or two amendments tried to clarify that. If we go over the page, Chair, and we turn to other issues about beyond powers or too wide, there were some I thought obvious comments that don't need much attention, like who pays for the cost of an on-site visit. That's not clear in the legislation. I mean, those issues don't need to be legislated for. It's clear the cost of on-site visit doesn't get recovered from the entity who visited. That's the cost borne by the FSP. It's a cost I would gather is even estimated in their budget process, which wouldn't obviously be known with exact certainty at the year in front, but you have to budget for the contingency. Again, there were comments such as seizing any document is too wide. Well, again, if you start limiting exactly what documents you can seize and what kind you could possibly seize, then there can even be objections on those specific types and what defines those specific types. Chair, we don't think it's reasonable to go to that level of detail in legislation, because all it can do is harm your regulatory power and harm what you're trying to achieve at the end of the day. If we turn the page to page 38, which again concerned removing documents from premises, this would not be the usual course of business, but you would have to allow for the possibility that most of the time they would make copies of the documents. And if documents are removed, they are removed against the issue of a receipt to the person. If we continue to over the page on naming and shaming, again, it seems that commentators are afraid that the registrar's powers are too wide when it comes to, for instance, naming and shaming or revealing any details of an inspection. So we don't agree with removing such a provision, but we are proposing an amendment in that regard that makes it a bit more specific, and that's on the extreme right-hand side at the bottom of page 39, which basically says well, okay, the registrar may make known, and then we break it down into three categories, the status and outcome of an inspection, just broadly, like I inspected X and the outcome was favorable or not. Two is details, if in the public interest, maybe the registrar may want to release further details, and then the details not only of an inspection, but also possibly an on-site visit, and that's what sub three deals with there. But the fundamental rights of naming and shaming, I don't think we can remove, but hopefully we have clarified, and that the power is not too wide. If we move to clause 46, a number of commentators said that the current clause, basically says an FSB must, if he conducts business with a person rendering financial services, that person themselves must be a registered FSB and licensed. And in the light of the comments received, we're proposing some amendments just to explain that a bit more, to clarify that in a bit more detail. So that's a proposed amendment that runs on the right-hand side. There were other comments, for instance, such as that similar provisions should be made to apply to a product supplier. Now, a product supplier falls outside the ambit of the fire tax, so we don't see how we can extend such a provision to a product supplier as well. So we didn't agree with that comment. On clause 47, which is on page 41, this clause primarily deals with key individuals. It deals with the fitness and propriety of these individuals. It deals of directors, members, partners, etc. I mean, there were comments, for instance, from the banking industry, as the House will remember, that banks should be excluded from this requirement because banks are already regulated by the Registrar of Banks under the Banks Act. So why are we duplicating this function? So we built in an amendment in another section where the registrar consults with other registrars in making these decisions. The registrar does this in any case, but we've made it clear in legislation that that will then be the case. And so we hope that addresses that concern. There were other comments, Chair, which seemed slightly anomalous, like what is a director? We must define what an executive director is, a non-executive director, an independent director. If you look at our current body of law, all these people are regarded as directors. So we disagree with having to go and define each one separately. There was also clarity required by the Banking Association and the Life Officers Association regarding a director, for instance, what is honesty, a person being a person of honesty and integrity, what does that actually mean? Again, we disagree with inserting a whole bunch of very detailed requirements in the Act, and the FSB will issue regulation, guidance, or directive in that regard to make it clear to people. But that sort of thing doesn't have to be specified in the Act. What the regulator does when looking at this is looking at international best practices, what is fit and proper. The last section on 8, sub 10, sub B, is merely an editorial correction, so I'm not going to speak to that, but rather speak to the bottom comment by the LOA, which was, and basically the clause they're specifically referring to is where the registrar has ability to intervene in the first instance and remove or debar an FSP. And I think the LOA's view was, well, first, it shouldn't work like that. The FSP should be the person debarring their representative. Don't give the registrar the right to intervene in the first instance. We don't agree with that provision, Chair, because there may be instances where the registrar has been intervened. So we're not supplanting the rights of, or obligation, actually, of the original, of the company to remove the financial service provider concerned. We're just saying the registrar should have the right to intervene. So we don't think there should be a change there. I'm just looking, Chair, the following comments on page 43 is rather lengthy. I don't know if I need to talk to it. The definition of key individual the comment was the definition of key individual already ensures that a director. So, I mean, I think the comment basically was that the current requirements are to be fit and proper are sufficient, so there's no reason why the registrar should be informed of changes to the board of a company which conducts financial services as a minor, whatever minor may be, but a minor aspect of its business. But we disagree with that because the intention is that all people who are involved in the business of providing financial services, whether it's minor, medium, or major, a major part of the business is irrelevant, and that those people must comply with honesty and integrity requirements. So you can't be dividing it up into different sort of segments depending on the primary business of the original company. There were a number of references made to materiality and what is material in clause 48, which is the following clause. I think the main point there is to highlight your end point that the registrar's decisions are subject to a partial and therefore must be fair and reasonable. So if something really is immaterial but the registrar is performing actions that are crazy, partial effectively covers that. We don't have to again refer to partial in that section because it applies. So you will see running throughout that clause check is a number of disagreements that both primarily relate to the materiality comment. How can remember the Banking Association insisted on consultation with other regulators that has been incorporated? That's under section 9.2, which is halfway through page 44. We're suggesting an amendment there which indicates that the registrar should go and consult with other regulators, which essentially just entrenches current practice. And then the two amendments here over the page are just editorial, so I'm not going to talk directly to them. We can move on to clause 51, which again talks about materiality. It seems like if we could remove the word material or materiality from law, we would all benefit. But I mean, we cannot define everything in legislation. Some things have to be left to judgment. And again, in terms of the proposed section 14.1, where the Banking Association and the Compliance Institute required what is in a material manner mean, the registrar will have to provide guidance in that regard through regulation and directive or guidance notes, because we can't legislate for everything. And then there was some complaint about that the proposed amendment effectively provides for the debarment of a representative who has contravened or failed to comply with the provision of the Act. And people were concerned that this is far too wide, it gives the registrar too much discretion, or it's unreasonable, and that clearly we don't agree with those comments. There was also a comment that the debarment criteria should be expanded to include serious non-compliance under the Act, and that in doing that you should be dealing only with fit and proper requirements, and we disagree with that too. Compliance with the Act as a whole is important. It's not only about fit and proper requirements and bolstering those requirements. And if you contravene those, then we'll take action. It's about compliance with the whole Act, of which fit and proper is a sliver. The amendment to section 14.2a is purely editorial. And on section 14.3a, Chair, we have suggested an amendment in the table bill originally that once an FSP takes action, they have, against the provider, they have a certain amount of time to inform the FSB as to what's going on. So there was a comment at the time we were providing was too short, and that we were proposing a reduction from 1 month, 30 days, to 15 days, and Banking Association said that was unreasonable because they had a branch office all over South Africa. How are they expected to finalize the entire debarment procedure in 2 weeks? But it's not that 30 or 15 days, whatever the case may be, only kicks in once those procedures have been finalized. So we've taken care of the Banking Association's concern in that regard. On clause 52, which follows, there were a number of... The main comment, I think, there, Chair, that needs speaking to is questions around if industrial relation action, legal challenges, where you allow the registrar to step in and tell someone this licensed individual should no longer be allowed to provide services. So the question is, then you have an employer, in virtual commas, you say an insurer, you have the FFP, you have the FFP. The question really is, can the FFP or the registrar step in and remove this person? And the comment there was, well, this is very problematic, we don't think it should occur. And say that the reason we need to include that provision fundamentally is because, let's say you have a naughty FFP. What happens, what the FFP has found in a few instances, is you have a naughty FFP, before the company you work for can take action, you resign, go to another company, start being naughty at that company. But the original company can't take action anymore because it's no longer part of the company. So in those sort of instances, you want the registrar to be able to step in and say, wait a second, you can't be moving from company to company and still conducting yourself in an improper manner. We can naturalize if you can do that. And I think that's a regulatory loophole we're trying to close. We're not trying to impose a situation where the registrar is taking over all the original functions of the particular industry participant concept. And Chair, I'm not going to say the word materiality again, which occurs over the page on 48, but it turns to a fair word by the end of this hearing. So let me just speak to the last comment on page 48, which is on section 14A3. And Sayer has a long comment there, and the gist of it is basically that we think they've incorrectly read the legislation that we're proposing. So we disagree with them, because what we're saying in response to their comment is that in the case where a registrar decides to debar a representative after having gone through the prescribed process, only subsequent to that, so the provider has 5 days to remove the debarred representative's name. So I think there was just a bit of misinterpretation by the commentator there. Again, I think that they thought you had to finalize the you have to debar the person within 5 days, which would be unreasonable. Clause 54 on page 49. I can just steal my colleague's water chair. Hold it. Joanne, I'll replace yours. Clause 54. There were comments received from a number of bodies, and that dealt with specifics. And if we look at the LOA's first comment, their comment was that any code or regulation drafted to control the provision of intermediary services must distinguish between type agents, who is a type agent, who is an independent broker, the right of the employer to remunerate and reward its type agents, etc. Now, again, we disagree with sticking that level of detail in the legislation. So we are saying that the concern shouldn't be addressed in the Act. The registrar will draft such a code of conduct that's after consultation with the advisory committee on which industry members sit, and often that's in consultation with the broader industry in general as well. So we don't see that as a problem. The last point by LISPR, which is, product suppliers fall outside the ambit of the FICE Act, so we don't agree that any amendment needs to be made with respect to bringing product suppliers into the net. If we move to Clause 55, the committee and the House will remember that the Banking Association proposed that we're being too tough on compliance officers. We can't expect as much from compliance officers as we expect from an auditor when it comes to checking compliance with various provisions of the Act. Here we disagree with it. The role of a compliance officer is to conduct monitoring programs, identify aspects of non-compliance, with the provider giving past information onto the registrar, so he assists the registrar tremendously, and I think compliance officers would generally agree with it. But in our view, it's really not clear why the commentator is saying that these requirements are too wide and onerous. I mean, at the end of the day, the compliance officer is only required to report the material irregularity of which he becomes aware during the performance of his duties. So we're not expecting anything more than that from the compliance officer. So we don't see why it's extending it a level too far. Chair, if we move to comments on section 17 sub 2 sub A, the specific comment from the South African Insurance Association was, what about future regulatory changes to criteria and guidelines? How will that be dealt with? And again, that's determined by the registrar, but the registrar doesn't do it in isolation. He does it in consultation. After consultation with the advisory committee, and usually again with industry, not only the advisory committee. So addressing what changes will occur in the future is already something the FSP has dealt with, even in the implementation of it. The FSP has to go through this exercise in any case. So on that comment note, there's no legislative proposal or amendment that should follow. I'm keeping silence on the first item on page 51, and we'll move to 56, Jim. Now, to the chair's delight, pages 51, 52, 53, those three pages deal with comments from the Independent Regulatory Board for Auditors and FICA, South African Institute of Chartered Accountants, and who are we to disagree with the whole body of chartered accountants? So, say we've taken a generally accepted accounting practice and all those other wonderful things into account. So, they suggested amendments here and there as to what we had to make that as tight as possible given current accounting standards and developments that are almost upon us. And that's their comments we are taking on board, Chair, and that's what you see in the right hand column. So, I'm not going to talk to those. If we then move to page 54, we shall ignore the full chair.
Yeah,
but anyway, the call was clearly promptly answered by the Parliamentary Speech Board. Section 19.3, a comment from IMASA, which basically says, can we please not use the words, can we rather use the words financial products instead of assets? So we've amended the section appropriately. So we don't think it makes a substantive change, it's more editorial. On section 19.7, and the committee in the House will remember again presentations by the Banking Association, which said, listen, our primary regulator is the SARB. If we want to change our financial year end, we go to the SARB. And what we're saying there is the registrar of financial service provider still needs a handle on changing financial year ends. So we're disagreeing fundamentally that we should remove that provision. What we're saying again is more that the registrar of financial service providers must go and consult other registrars. I mean, that is the benefit that both registrars know exactly what's going on and company X is doing exactly what. And so that's the proposal in the far right-hand column, which makes that clear. And that the comment is effectively repeated over the page with respect to the financial year end. The comments on the South African Insurance Association was if the existing right of a business to change its financial year end becomes subject to regulatory discretion, then there should be a requirement that approval may not be unreasonably withheld and a maximum period must be stipulated within which the regulator should respond. Seems reasonable at first instance, but it's not something I would be comfortable with sticking in legislation. The registrar, you have to say, though some people may not like it, and so, or some industry people may not like it, sometimes you've just got to trust the regulator to fulfill their mandate. And that's kind of what we're saying here, is the registrar has put measures in place to deal with these things. The registrar has to put measures in place to license financial service providers, has to put measures in place to do anything. So let's not put maximum time periods within you expect the registrar to respond, because if we have to do that, then we have to say, well, what if he doesn't? So then we have to put a whole lot of contingency clauses as to what happens if he doesn't. We being treated, are also there to make sure that the regulators do what they're supposed to do. So we will also apply the appropriate pressure if we think that things are not being done at time, you see. Clause 57, Chair, Joanne has spoken to, so I'm not going to repeat that, and that really deals with a limit on the penalty that could be imposed. That check concludes what is in the bill. But there are some comments that were made, obviously, outside of what the bill actually addressed. So let's address those as well. The Banking Association, in the Fines Act, said that the term intermediary services is defined in too wide a way and creates a whole lot of problems, and they suggested altering the definition. The problem with what they suggested in altering the definition, the effect of that would be that the rendering of intermediary services to a client who doesn't enter into a transaction falls outside the Act. So what does that mean? That means someone, an intermediary, for instance, gives you advice. You don't buy into the product because for whatever reason. But this advice is actually horrific. Does not suit you. Wasn't done on a proper financial needs analysis, etc. If we remove in that specific definition, it's sub A from that definition. If we remove sub A, it means it's okay to drive recklessly as long as you don't cause an accident. And Chewy, that sort of mindset is not right. So we're saying we have, even if you don't enter into an actual contract, there are still things you should still be behaving properly. And that's why we didn't agree with deleting the sub A of that specific definition. The Compliance Institute's comment, I'm not going to speak to it, seems more of a misinterpretation than anything else. If we move to the next, what I would call substantive comment, then is the definition of deposit under what is called financial product insight. And the Compliance Institute says that, well, financial product was not amended in our proposed amendments. It still includes the deposit as defined in the Banks Act. And they specifically suggested that credit products should be excluded from the definition of financial products. Why did they suggest that? Well, the National Credit Act takes care of that. But we disagree with that. We disagree with the exclusion of a credit product. Money lending transactions and all so-called credit products fall outside the ambit of deposit as defined in the Banks Act. So we think it's a bit of a misinterpretation. They're therefore excluded from the ambit of this Act. No amendment there is necessary. We have suggested a small editorial amendment to Section 11.2, and that's simply when the licensee should advise the registrar of a lapsing of his license, what the current act says. We're just saying he must do so in writing. So that's the amendment on the extreme right-hand side of page 56. If we turn over the page, and the page is 57, Chair, to page 59, all deal with the enforcement committee issues Joanne referred to earlier. So those are consequential amendments to effect changes to the enforcement committee as indicated by Joanne, which only leaves us with clause 75 at the end of the bill, which was a comment that a certain section of the Act should take effect at least 9 months after the promulgation. Now, we disagree with them in that specific instance about a 9 month period. We're just saying it's 3 months, and we suggested wording on the far right hand side. But the House will remember that the bill does contain a number, contain that whole clause is about transitional provision. Also, the clause prior to clause 70, is it 74? One of the two subsequent clauses also provide that the Act can take effect at different times, or different sections of the Act can take effect at different times. So that will allow us to be flexible in the application of the Act, allow people time to adjust. So we're not being unreasonable with any of the changes in terms of timing. We recognize it takes time for industry to change contracts if necessary, or to change procedures, and that's the whole reason for those transitional provisions.
Chair, I think, as I said when we were here last,
and increasingly becoming like a ready-made. He's an extremely good job, so we have nothing to add here.
Chief, can I note that that's quite a scary thought.
Okay. I see here that there are a number of areas and these places where wedding still has to be finalized. I think it would assist with the process to know exactly when it's going to be finalized and when the committee is going to have slides of the original finalized so that we can rely on that. And you also have accommodated a number of the ones from the independent regulatory board of auditors of the year. And whether out of fear or any other reason, but the amendments that you propose, have you asked them with the, I mean, just to check whether they actually address the concerns they have raised, so that you do not end up with those, but only to find that they did not address them. Just before I take questions from members, can I just get the answer for the two questions?
Thank you, Chair. We did consult with the accounting bodies on those wording.
When are we getting the ones where weddings still have to be finalized?
I'm trying to get the attention of my parliamentary office. So we've got both of them written down and into a separate document, but we have to engage the state law advisor as well as the law advisor of parliament. Just in terms of getting an agreement in terms of the wording. But we ourselves need to just go through it again to ensure that what we intend is what we've got. But we hopefully will by Friday be able to submit the final document already scrutinized by the state law advisor and your advisors to the committee.
I'm not too sure because they're actually also determined as to when exactly we will be able to formalize the we also have had time. Normally, it is proper when we get this to also discuss it with the staff, but also to just pass it on to also to our team. Okay, members?
Somewhere in your presentation, you mentioned that when, where there is a breach, I don't know, I need clarity on that one. And that breach is being settled at the court. Does it automatically mean that you will hold everything, the administrative procedures, like the penalty, the internal process for penalties. Because the issue here is that court procedure might not necessarily address administrative problems. I want to check what is it that you are putting as a safeguard to ensure that we are able to address everything that might arise. Thank you.
Okay, and I want us to try and actually locate the actual here with you with responding to specific questions that have been raised. I think it's very important to not reopen the discussion. So
Thank you, Chair. Thanks very much for your response. On page number 7, with his reference to the principal officer, several commentators made comments about this particular item, and in particular they said that the principal officer should be paid and employed by the fund. Your response quite correctly points out that it gets very expensive, especially for the smaller funds, and then points out that the employer or the administrator pays for the principal officer. Now, the employer and the administrator are very different entities. The employer is a participant in the fund, and the trustees cannot change the employer, whereas the administrator is a service provider to the fund, and the trustees can change the administrator. So I'm just concerned that if there was some kind of difficulty that the board was having with the principal officer, they could get rid of the administrator and also the principal officer. So shouldn't the provision rather say that the employer should be paying the principal officer? That's the first one. And then, secondly, from many of the comments received, it was very clear that entities see inspections and visits by the FSP as something unusual and strange and to be concerned about, if you look at the things that they want to control. I think we must bear that in mind, is why is that the case, and how is that going to change when this gets implemented? And then the third question, maybe more comment, is that we've spoken a lot about the principal officer and protecting the members from the principal officer. But what about protecting the members from the trustees? For example, if the board of trustees pays itself too much or that he does follow his own governance, I know there's rules and regulations in place, but are they tight enough? Thanks, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. Three questions from my side. On page 27, where you disagree with the comment from the Banking Association on that first point, I'm just concerned because it says that the amendment states that new participants will be designated after meeting the set criteria. I think we find that there's so many smaller institutions or companies or formations that basically start to participate in that environment without necessarily meeting the set criteria. Doesn't that leave the door open that you haven't got an equal playing field? And my assumption was, or perception was, that was a concern from the Banking Association, that there's other non-banks that can operate that who's not necessarily meeting that set criteria, and it means that they are outside and they can, you know, there's some loopholes that can be found there. That's the first point. And then on page 31, I just want to make sure, with regards to the Financial Institutions, the Protection of Funds Act, how is the chairperson of the Enforcement Committee selected, elected, or appointed? So in other words, I just want to look at the impartiality of that person and how because there's quite a lot of discretions in that specific person, and how, you know, how can that impartiality be, and knowledge and expertise and skills be assured? And then the second point on that act is that the chairperson has got the right and the discretion to decide on penalties. And it might be huge penalties involved. And I would imagine that some of that cases can be very intrigued and very complex and very complicated. But it's in the discretion of the chairperson whether to allow legal representation or not. And I'm just wondering whether that cannot and will not lead in most of the cases to an enormous lengthy period where they will anyway appeal to the court afterwards if they are not happy with what happens. And sometimes you might not have the most knowledgeable person then appearing before that committee, and you know whether that justifies it and whether it shouldn't be a right for affected party to have legal and skilled and knowledgeable representation there. Thank you, Chair.
The FSB is a Schedule 3 entity in terms of the PFMA. That means no fruitless, wasteful expenditure. And in that spirit, Chair, they will answer most of these questions. And I can chip in when necessary. If Joanne wants to do one of them before we hand over to the FSB, I think each of the FSB has expertise, for instance, on fire, on pensions, etc., on enforcement, and can answer the concerns adequately.
I can just respond to the first question raised. I mean, I'm not sure I've captured your question correctly. We started applied to two situations. So one is we've commenced administrative enforcement proceedings, but a criminal charge has also been laid. And the other one is a decision has been taken, and we insist that the decision must be implemented pending sort of report saying what we're trying to achieve in terms of the double jeopardy for us is an open legal question. I think there's opinions on the one way and opinions the other way around. I think as the executive, we feel we should have the double jeopardy. We should be able to go for criminal proceedings plus administrative, because if and then we're willing to take the risk to be challenged on it. Because, for instance, if you have a person that's committed fraud, you want to go for him criminally, but you also might want to go for an individual director or board member in respect of an administrative penalty. So for us, it's the most appropriate response to the most appropriate transgression. And I think in some instances, it does warrant having both the administrative penalty and the criminal proceeding. But, I mean, yeah, there's a huge discussion between us and the state law advisors on that issue. They have a more risk-averse approach, and we have a more risk-taking approach in that respect. So in the end, it was agreed that we will not insist on having that in the legislation. And I think the same applies in terms of FIC. So basically, at the moment, a criminal charge has been laid. It will stay any administrative enforcement proceedings that might be pending against that person. In terms of a decision that has been taken either by the appeal board or by the enforcement committee, we feel those decisions should be implemented, but we've created an opportunity for the affected person to either approach the chairperson of the appeal board or the court to say, well, can we suspend the application or the implementation of the decision? So there is an opportunity, but we want as a rule to say it must be implemented unless a decision has been taken that it can be suspended, and not the other way around. And that's purely for us to be able to act in the public interest. I'm not sure if I did answer your question. And well, we have to all have administrative problems, etc., will be resolved when a person applies to say can we suspend that, because that's a part of what the chairperson and the court will take into account.
Questions raised by Dr. George regarding principal officers and the function of principal officers. You have made a suggestion that possibly the employer should be required to pay the principal officer. Chair, you have, amongst the 13,500 funds we have at the moment, you have all different shapes and sizes of funds. You have massive funds that obviously can afford to appoint a
full-time executive principal officer, and you've got smaller funds that where this cost of employing the principal officer, which is eating into the benefits of members significantly. What normally happens in those cases is that the trustees are made up of member trustees and employer-appointed trustees. That the employer-appointed trustees would take on the responsibility of the principal officer as part of his functions. Our understanding is that that employee acting as principal officer of the fund does not pay any additional money for that, for acting as principal officer. It's part of his normal function, job description with his employer. That's normally the case. The issue with administrators and principal officers coming out as administrators, our understanding is part of the negotiation that funds would have with the administrator would be the provision of principal officer related function, and that's part of the negotiation between the funds and the administrator concerned. The point is raised with regard to, and I know Dr. George put it down as a comment regarding trustees and protection of members from trustees. At this stage, we all know that the reform document that National Treasury has put out speaks to some of the issues around trustees, etc., etc., etc. The current requirement of appointment of trustees is 50% from the employer, 50% of the trustees representing members. Is a requirement, obviously, that that where you've got member trustees appointed or any trustee appointed, typically would not have the required knowledge that training should kick in, training should be provided. Really, as it would be issued a circular pension fund, a PS 130, which deals quite extensively from our perspective of matters regarding the governance of a board, which includes the requisite training the trustees should go through and how they should govern themselves at board level. Our intention in the future is that once this PF 130 is bedded down, that we actually want to bring it in by a regulation to make it a requirement. So that's going to be our approach going forward with regard to tightening up and improving the whole governance aspect with regard to trustees. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. Just a comment on the question by the Honourable Dr. George with regard to on-site visits. Placed in a proper context, the involvement of ongoing supervision as a regulatory tool has now come to include on-site visits. It's done by most regulators locally and internationally. The only objective with the amendment is to get some the enabling basis in the Act. It's nothing unusual. It's not sinister. In fight with our 14,500 licensed FSPs, we conduct some 150 to 250 on-site visits. It's an informal way of ensuring that financial service providers comply with the Act. It's a way of assistance to such financial service providers, help them with their practice management, help them with their compliance register that they are required to keep in terms of the Act. And it's been proven beneficial for both sides, and I'm confident that the lessons that Jürgen can say from the pension side are practically the same. Thank you, Chair.
I think there's two issues that I was saying, the NPS question and then the impartiality of the enforcing committee and legal representation. I think for us, it's important to create a discretion in respect of legal representation or not. What do you mean? I mean, if you look at culture as well, it tries to create one system for complex and non-complex systems. And I think that also what we are trying to put in place is the same system to fit all sizes. But it might not be appropriate in all instances to provide for legal representation. And all that it means is that you chase up the costs of the proceeding. I think the whole purpose of having an administrative sanction process or an appeal process, an administrative proceeding that precedes sort of the judiciary stepping into the dispute, is to have a speedy resolution of the matter. I do agree with you that in the end, probably most of them will end up in court, but I think there might also be quite a number of things that won't. I think the moment, it's also, I think, for the chairperson of the appeal board, specifically, remember that it's a completely separate institution than the FSB. There is also a reputational risk associated with the individual serving on those boards. So if they don't act in the most appropriate manner or a reasonable manner, despite the fact that you might be able to appeal the decision or take it on review, there is still also backlash against that person the same. I mean, I think through the whole proceeding of this bill and the FIC that's already been dealt with, people feel very wary about regulators and appeal boards and the people that sit on them and their reasonableness and ability to act impartially and objectively. And I think there's one can't entrench within legislation. At some point, you need to trust. I think there are remedies available to people where they feel that regulators have stepped over the what would be a very reasonable boundary. Also, the appeal board as well as the enforcement committee. So I think our view is that we've adequately provided in the legislation for reasonableness. Promotion of access of administrative justice applies. There's nothing more that we can actually write into the law to ensure the impartiality of a person serving on either the appeal board and or the enforcement committee. So I'm not exactly sure. I mean, maybe if there are any specific situations in terms of wording where you feel one could probably further improve it, it will be there. I think in legal representation for access, the whole concept of administrative enforcement provisions or administrative processes is to have a speedy process. And for us, myself being a lawyer, legal representation usually sort of impedes the speedy resolution. We feel that the discretion should be there, but there are also remedies available to people should they feel that people, the chairperson of both committees acted inappropriately.
We do have an enforcement committee under the Security Services Act at the moment. So, I'm going to ask Gerard van Deventer, who is intimately involved with that process, to take us through some of the questions raised by my honourable member, Marais, because that is equally meant to apply to the widened enforcement committee we're talking about.
Thank you, Mr. Jefferson. Yes, it is correct that the whole idea of an enforcement committee is not new. We've been doing it since 2004, but contained to capital markets. In other words, for market abuse, that insider trading, price manipulation, and false statements. And I'm happy to say that it's working very, very well. The whole idea is, of course, to speed up the process. We used to enforce our anti-market abuse legislation through the civil courts. It worked well, but it was expensive and it took very long. So the mandate behind this legislation was to speed it up, to make it more expedient. And that's why it's slightly different from what you would see in the courts. Now, the first point about legal representation, I totally agree. Legal representation, when there's a hearing before the enforcement committee, is very important. And in fact, my current chairperson of the enforcement committee has said that it's the retired judge president of the Transvaal. He has said that he will always allow legal representation when there's a hearing, not because he's protecting the rights of the respondents, but because it actually assists the enforcement committee when you hear counsel arguing things out. The point is, however, so I assume it will always be granted. There's no doubt about that. But the problem is this. There won't always be a hearing. If you look at that subsection, you'll see in subsection F, it actually says the chairperson will decide whether he's going to be addressed on the issues or not. Now, that works, it sounds a bit funny, but how that works and how the present one works as well is that the FSB will make certain allegations in affidavit with a charge sheet. We call it the particulars of contravention. That gets filed with the committee, the enforcement committee, and it's also served on the respondents. They then have a time period to reply on affidavit, and the enforcement committee will then consider the case. Now, if there's any disputes of fact, or if it's at all a difficult case, the chairperson will then inform the parties that there's going to be a day when you address me, and in such a case, legal representation is an absolute must. However, we foresee extending this enforcement committee to the whole of the FSB, that not all cases are going to be like that. There will be such simple cases that the enforcement committee will operate the way it was intended to originally, namely, the case will be decided on the papers, in other words, in chambers. So there won't be a hearing day. And in such a case, talking about legal representation that is a right is a bit of a nonsense, which we can live with except for this, is going to cause interpretation problems. Because somebody is going to argue that if legal representation is a must, it's assumed that a hearing is also a right, which is certainly not the case, and there we are in line internationally. And I think that's the only real issue about legal representation. It has worked very well to date. We've had quite a few cases go through it. In some cases, not only, in fact, in all cases but one to date, not only did the respondents not make use of their right of legal representation, they've actually gone further than that. They said, we're not going to attend. We have an idea what the penalty is going to be. We've entered into a plea bargain, lots of cases, and we are happy for the committee to decide in chambers or for the FSB to appear. And that has made it fast and effective. And I think that's the big issue there.
And also, if the complainant is unhappy, you can still take the committee on appeal.
Yes, of course, Mr. Jason, that's correct. That there's now into the new bill, there's a full right of appeal to the High Court. As far as the appointment of the chairperson is concerned and the deputy chairperson, that is done by the board because this is a committee, the board. And if the board, as a backdoor, fails to do so, we've written into the bill that the committee itself may appoint a chairperson. But the stipulations in the bill, as Joanne has pointed out, is firstly that it must be either a judge, probably a retired judge, or an advocate or an attorney of more than 10 years standing. That goes for the chairperson and the deputy chairperson. So by the reason of their background and their training, they should be independent. And, of course, they have no links to the FSB. None of the enforcement committee members have links to the FSB. Secondly, we've also written into the bill, because understand that the way the committee works, it's a big committee, but for specific cases, panels are appointed to deal with that case. So you can have multiple panels on the same day, for instance, one on a pension funds contravention, one on an insider trading contravention, and so forth. We've also written into the bill that the chairperson of all those panels in every case must also be one of the senior lawyer groups. So you'll have that independence there as well. As far as the members of the committee is concerned, and remember, a panel or a committee will sit on the basis of a majority vote as to whether somebody is guilty and should have a penalty imposed or not. Those members are all totally independent from the FSB. They will be persons appointed for their knowledge and expertise. To date, what we've done, if it's an insider trading case and you really need to understand how the market operates, we will pick a retired stockbroker to sit with a judge. And in addition to that, for instance, we will pick a retired investment manager. We've had a recent case, Berman and Stacey, where a hedge fund manager manipulated the share price at the end of the quarter, the window dressing that everybody is aware of. And that panel consisted of a judge, a stockbroker, if I remember correctly, but most importantly, a retired investment manager. And she was able to cut through all the words that doesn't matter to get to the heart of the matter. And the matter was decided very quickly, and a $2 million penalty was imposed. Thank you.
Retired judge, retired stockbroker, and retired investment expert. Other questions, members? Comments? Look, I don't know. We'll decide once we have all your amendments also before us, and you would then have to take into consideration where the, you know, and how soon the formal consideration is going to take place. We want to come to ourselves now, until such time that you want to answer, and she just told us that the involvement of the Patricia should be called much later. You know, but you said being one yourself, you know how. So you were including yourself. Members, thank you. There are just a few. Is it here, sir? Is it? Yeah, and is there lunch also? The meeting will take a decision whether we are going to have lunch, because we had ordered lunch and the members not behaved. But we are also circulating just a few, I would want a decision after I've done this. We circulated the two reports, our portfolio committee report on the budget votes 11 and 7. I would want to ask members to read through the reports, and perhaps what we would need to do after tea is to come back and see whether we need to go through them here in the committee, because there is not a report that from the basis of our debate. So if the tea is here outside, can I be advised whether tea is ready outside? And also, Ms. Avikari at the back there wanted members, there have been invitations by the Minister of Finance to members, and members have been asked to RSVP. And we said for those members that haven't, because we want to know what kind of people attend, it is in order for members to do that by a show of hands, which is there. And Ms. Avikari will then confirm who are there. Where the members are going to be attending. Have you received those messages? Can I see the heads now? Mr. Murray, Dr. George, Ms. Vila, Gordo, Mr. Mlado.
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Mr. Mgoni, Mr. Johnson. Okay. Is that here, sir? We'll correct for tea, and then we'll come back and take a decision on the report. But thanks very much, Mr. Chairman.